Smith College, Radcliffe, and the University of Chicago before embarking upon a rich and fascinating and productive career that has taken her to the University of Toronto, to the University of California, to Princeton, where she was Henry Charles Lee Professor of History from 1981 to 1996, and then, now, back to the University of Toronto, where she is currently an adjunct professor of history, anthropology, and medieval studies, and a senior fellow with the Center for Comparative Literature. I think a title, that last group, that captures, to some degree at least, the interdisciplinary scope of her interests. Professor Zeman Davis has lectured around the world, held many prestigious positions, and won many honorary degrees. On paper, she is indeed a very formidable scholar. In person, however, she is not so much formidable as vital, intelligent, and engaging. She has been described as one of the greatest scholars now at work in the humanities, and as a human presence of rare grace and generosity. In this age of microchips and the bottom line, Natalie Zeman Davis reminds us of the inestimable value of the humanities. Please join with me in giving her a very warm welcome.
Thank you very much, Cheryl Grace, for that graceful introduction. Thank you very much to the Vancouver Institute for inviting me to be part of an institution which I gather is 80 years in history and is deeply engaged both the university community and the Vancouver community. So I'm particularly glad to be here. I'm glad to be able to be presenting work that is very much in process, since I gather that the discussion is also a part of the tradition with lots of questions and answers, and I look forward to your thoughts and your suggestions. I'm going to be talking about a test case in this very interesting and sensitive matter of the history of slavery and attitudes toward it here, as you'll see, in the instance of a Jewish community and a very interesting Jewish man in the colony of Suriname. Now, I didn't know where Suriname was, particularly years ago when I started this project. It's in South America. It's in between the former British Guiana, now Guyana, and Guyane, and it's just north of Brazil. So in case there was anybody else who thought it was like I once did in the Pacific, it's not. So, braided histories, Jews, Africans, and slavery. Partway up the Suriname River, amid the rainforests of tropical Suriname, live a people called the Nasis. In the 18th century, as today, they were part of the Saramaka, or Maroons, or Bush Negroes, that is, Africans who had escaped from the plantations of Suriname and had established free villages of their own. The Nasis were one of the most important clans of the Saramaka, taking their patronymic not from the West African communities of their ancestors, but from the plantations of the Nasi, N-A-S-S-Y, the Nasi family at Jew Savannah, from which their founders had fled decades before. Their language, Saramakan, was drawn in part from the Portuguese spoken by their former masters, and in it they reminisced about the feats of their warriors, their continuing raids in the plantations to facilitate slave escapes, and their Nasi ingenuity at building canoes in imitation of the local Indian Caribs and Arawaks. When they talked of the water, forest, and other great spirits who supported them in their endeavors, the Nasis used the African word obia. When they talked of the food taboos of the father in each family, they used the Hebrew word treph. The Saramaka Nasis are one of the several strands in the braided history of and around David de Isaac Coenasse, a descendant of those Portuguese Jews who had come to Suriname in the 17th century. I was attracted to this story for two reasons. First, because of the paradoxical combination of freedom and slavery in this New World setting. When French Huguenot refugees arrived in Suriname in the late 17th century, denied all religious rights in France by the revocation of their Edict of Nantes, they set up slave plantations, but gave them names like La Liberté. The Jews in most parts of Europe had no legal rights to the full ownership of land, and nowhere in Europe did they have full civic rights. In the Dutch colony of Suriname, they could own and inherit large tracts of land and were virtually citizens, as you'll see. But it was within the setting of a slave economy. I wondered how this paradox was lived out in the character of Jewish-African relations in Suriname. Second, David Nasi and his multiple worlds are an especially interesting case in which to examine cultural mixture, that is, forms of creolité, as we say in French, or hybridity, métissage culturel, the subject of my new project on strategies for identity in mixed figures in the 16th, 18th, and 20th centuries. The winds of the European Enlightenment, with their call for human rights, were blowing in the literary landscapes of Suriname. And I have been wondering what impact they had on the Portuguese Jews. And in a world where the Nasis and other Maroons were, in a sense, keeping kosher, I have been wondering what Obias were helping or haunting the Jews. David Isaac Coenasse came into the world in 1747, the son of Isaac, the notary and record keeper of the Portuguese Jewish community. Already a century earlier, his Nasi ancestors had been one of the Sephardic families that had acquired sugar plantations and had built a synagogue at Jews' Savannah, about 3 or 4 hours of rowing up the Suriname River from the town of Paramaribo. By mid-18th century, when David Nasi was born, the plantations were producing coffee, cocoa, cotton, and timber, as well as sugar, and the slave population had increased to 50,000 persons. The Maroon villages of free Africans had also grown, now up to about a few thousand people. They were often at war with the settlers and were encouraging slaves still to run away. The Jewish community was now composed both of Sephardim, persons of the Portuguese Jewish nation, as Nasi preferred to call them and as they called themselves, and of Ashkenazic Jews from German-speaking lands, each with their separate congregation. The Dutch Reformed settlers and Huguenots were now added German Lutherans, some Catholics, and missionary Moravian brethren trying to convert the Maroons, the Indian Caribs, and the slaves. Handsome new synagogues had grown up, one for the Portuguese, one for the Germans, not far from the Christian churches in the cosmopolitan town of Paramaribo. Its streets were crowded with Dutch officials and traders of many nationalities, and with blacks and colored, free and slave, working as domestics and in the local crafts. This disparate population lived somewhat restively under a local governor who himself reported to the Society of Suriname back in the Netherlands. From the beginning, the Jews had a role in colonial administration. In marked contrast to Europe, where Jews could not legally bear arms, in Suriname, there was a Jewish militia with Jewish captains going into action both against French attackers and against the Maroons. There was also an elite corps of about 200 freed African slaves, the Black Rangers, captained by Dutch officers. Though no Ashkenaz or Sephard held high office, male Jews were allowed to vote for the candidates in the various council offices. Indeed, all free male residents of the colony had this right, including free blacks. The Jews had frequent political consultation and correspondence with the governor, and were appointed to lesser posts, such as notary or hospital physician. This, too, is in contrast with Europe, where Jewish political influence could operate only informally through the Parnassim, as the officers of the synagogue were called, or through the court Jew or royal financiers. During the years when David Nasi was growing up, an important economic change took place. Eager for expansion, the Suriname planters took advantage of ready credit from Amsterdam. In 1769 and 1770, wrote Nasi, it seemed as though the age of gold had been renewed for the colony. But the outcome was a crash in Amsterdam and on the market, in which the Jewish owners were especially hard hit. In 1700, the Jews had been a third of the settler population and had possessed a third of Suriname's plantation and a third of its slaves. In the 1780s, only 8% of the plantations had Jewish owners, and most of them were small affairs, timber plantations with 40 slaves or less. David Nasi himself had an active part in that plantation economy for just a few years early in his first marriage. He began as a notary, an adjunct to his father, serving the Jews of the Portuguese nation, and married young to a cousin, Esther Nasi. At age 23, he took advantage of those golden age loans, bought a coffee plantation with about 30 slaves, and went to live there with his wife and young daughter. 3 years later, he was bankrupt, blaming the neglected crops and fields on a sudden mortality among his Africans. Back he went to Jew Savannah, selling some of his household slaves for cash and trading in secondhand goods. What he didn't relinquish were the books in his library, growing library. By 1782, it numbered over 430 volumes, this in the rainforest, in the jungle forest. It was the largest private library in Suriname, and that was when he was young. He kept growing. Meanwhile, he apprenticed to a local physician, pharmacist, began to practice medicine, and became active in the Jewish community, finally becoming one of the regents of the Mahamat, that is, the Portuguese word for the congregational board of the synagogue. A French official from the neighboring colony of Cayenne described young Nasi in those years, an extraordinary man, especially when one considers that he has never left Suriname since he was born. He has succeeded with no help but his own genius in raising himself above the errors of his sect. The French official was a Catholic. He has succeeded in deepening the picture of Jewish history and in learning methodically Arabic, Chaldean, Rabbinical Hebrew, and most of the modern languages, which he speaks with purity. He spends 8 hours every day in his study and is in correspondence with celebrated men in Europe. That's a somewhat exaggerated portrait. He certainly didn't know Chaldean and Arabic, but it gives you the impression of what he was like. By 1785, Nasi moved to the town of Paramaribo with his family. There he continued his medical practice and pharmacy, played a major role in rewriting the rules governing the congregation of the Portuguese Jews, and plunged into the literary life of the capital. We'll now turn to that literary life, but already I think you can see the possibilities and asymmetries in Nasi's entangled mental universe. He was a Jew in a world dominated by Christians, a Creole born and bred in Suriname rather than in Holland, an imperial settler in lands that once belonged to Caribs, Arawaks, and Wayanas, a European master in an economy of enslaved Africans. The mixture of Jewish with non-Jewish European cultures appears first in Nasi's library and literary society. That library, inherited from his father and purchased from Amsterdam with the advice of local Frenchmen, was made up of hundreds of books in Hebrew, French, Dutch, Spanish, and Italian. Along with Jewish prayer books and scriptures and his medical and pharmaceutical texts was the whole apparatus of the European Enlightenment and the Republic of Letters. Montesquieu, Voltaire, Rousseau, and the Abbé Raynal. Adam Smith, Isaac Newton, John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, David Hume, and other scientific and philosophical writers. And many of the great novels, theater, poems of the Spanish, French, Italian, and Spanish, of the Spanish, French, Italian traditions. Medallions of Voltaire and Rousseau and a brand new electrical machine were in his study shelf, along with his Jewish tefillin and prayer shawl. They're right next to each other. A member of both the Natural History Society and the Literary Society of Suriname, he was also a founder of Docendo Docemur, that is, the Literary Society of the Jews of the Portuguese nation. Twice a week they met, discussing readings on the history of the Romans, the Jews, of Holland, commerce, navigation, and more generally, quote, on the progress of the human spirit. Now, in 1784, the members of the Docendo Docemur read a French translation of Christian Dohm's recent German tract on the civic amelioration of the Jews, in which the counselor to the King of Prussia called for an end to civil exclusion of the Jews. Tunasi and his fellows, the Jews of Suriname, with their voting rights and their own militia, seemed a proof of Dohm's prediction that, quote, the Jews can become, in general, as good citizens as Christians once they're permitted to do so. So Nasi composed a letter to Dohm, thanking this illustrious and worthy friend of humanity for his book, as an antidote, and this is all quotations, to all the prejudices which reign in the hearts of men, and saying that the Portuguese Jewish community rejoiced in its lot, living under the philosophical tolerance which is the emblem of the August Republic of Holland, our mother country. Well, Dohm was very taken aback and wrote the regents asking for more details. Now, Nasi intended simply to answer with a history and description of the Jews of Suriname. But then he consulted the archives of the Portuguese community, Jewish community, where he found, quote, that the history of the Jews established in Suriname is so connected and, so to speak, identified with that of the colony in general, and the events from which the very origin of the colony involved the first Jewish settlers are so interlaced, his French here is enchaîné, he was writing in French, with those of the other inhabitants of the colony, that it has been morally impossible for us to separate them in order to write a separate history of the nation. Thus, in 1788, Nasi wrote in French, because he could write in French as well, and published in Paramaribo, under the name of all the regents of the Portuguese Jewish nation, a historical essay on the colony of Suriname, really the first historical essay of that colony. Here, an account of the English, and especially the Dutch in Suriname, is entwined with the activities and presence of the Jews there, from early settlement to present-day theater. In his preface, he affirms, we of the Jewish community regard the colony as a kind of political patrimony in which we enjoy liberty and franchise. For the conservation of its happiness, opulence, and well-being, we would voluntarily sacrifice all that we have. The historical essay is a braided history, born of the experience of Suriname and of the Enlightenment values discussed in its literary societies. Well, how easy was Nasi's movement between the synagogue and the literary society, between those Hebrew books and the French books on his library shelf? He gives the impression that the two frames fit well together for him. All humans adore the same God, although in different manners, he wrote. The Jewish manner, its liturgical prescriptions, and its law were extremely important to him. Warmly attached to the forms of his sect was how one Protestant described him. And Nasi spoke feelingly of the majesty of the synagogue at Jew Savannah and the sculptured cedar armoire in which the rolls of the Torah were kept. But this loyalty was not an obstacle in his mind to loyalty to the rights of men and citizens. We were men before we were Jews, he said. And he characterized his revision of the ordinances of the Portuguese Jewish community in Enlightenment language as, quote, purging our Jewish ecclesiastical institutions of the religious despotism and fanaticism that has led to endless quarrels and divisions. Influenced by the German Jewish Enlightenment leader, that's called the Jewish Enlightenment is called the Haskalah, influenced by the German Haskalah leader Moses Mendelssohn, Nasi had rethought God's special promise to the children of Israel and the mission of Torah so that they were not to be in impossible conflict with universal values as defined by the European Enlightenment. He described with approval a Jewish military action that had taken place in Suriname on the Jewish Day of Atonement, the Yom Kippur, the most holy day of the year, thus illustrating how the Jewish law could sometimes be bent, rightfully be bent, when civic need required it. Nasi agreed with Mendelssohn's view that all laws of Judaism refer to or are based upon eternal truths of reason, or remind us of them and rouse us to ponder them. The arguments Nasi had were not between the Jewish and the Enlightenment frame, but within that Enlightenment frame. First against Voltaire, that hero of tolerance, who had written, Nasi thought, unjustly against the Jews, rendering them hideous in the eyes of the world. How inconsistent this was with Voltaire's true philosophy, with a disinterested philosophy, without prejudice. Second, against detractors of the Jews in Suriname itself. In the 1750s, for example, there had been hot contestation around certain policies of the governor in Suriname. Most of the Jewish notables sided with the governor, and the Dutch opposition party petitioned for the exclusion of Jews henceforth from the vote. The endeavor failed, but Nasi still fumed as he retold the story 30 years later. They calumniate the Jews, he wrote. They call Jew Savannah a den of thieves. They claim Jewish votes are bought by the governor. Nasi went on to defend the Jewish procedure of supporting candidates and asked, what is the meaning of this privilege to nominate the colony's magistrates? Doesn't a free Negro who owns only a hovel and a patch of land enjoy the same right? Is this democratic liberty granted to the inhabitants of a colony who work both for their own well-being and for that of the mother country, susceptible to such childish and unjust criticisms? Well, so far, this picture of David Nasi's mental world and its mixtures seems merely an interesting colonial variant on the mixtures found in the European Enlightenment and in the early stages of the Jewish Enlightenment, the Jewish Haskalah. Nasi would be a figure to place next to Moses Mendelssohn and other Jewish thinkers who are finding a way to shape a Jewish identity within a consciously universal frame. And I say he's an interesting variant because these European Jewish Enlightenment figures aren't involved in politics, aren't in countries where they have political experience. When Nasi speaks and makes his arguments, he makes them from more than 100 years of civic life. But the story is more complicated than that. As the reference to the free Negro with his patch of land suggests, European settlers are by no means the only actors in the historical essay or in Nasi's interior life or in the Jewish community's interior life. There are occasionally Amerindians in his story, especially in connection with the early settlement of Suriname, with military encounters and peacemaking, and with the service of some, quote, good Indians in troops used against the warring Maroons. But Nasi's main interest in the Caribs was cultural, as evidenced by his French, Carib, Latin, Hebrew dictionary composed as a young man. Impressed by their knowledge of medicinal plants, he began to collect plant lore from Indian and African healers both. You'll hear more in a moment about the Africans. planning eventually to publish it for the use of physicians everywhere. A first report he presented to the Natural History Society in Paramaribo in 1789, and then again a few years later to the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. To the latter, he insisted on the importance of the continuous discovery of the virtue of plants, the qualities that made them useful for the human body, as opposed to the abstract Linnaean project of naming plants, classifying them, and understanding their sexual system. Quote, formerly, the Arabs, the Greeks, and the people of the Indus, and in our days, the natives of America and the Africans who have been transported here, furnished us and still furnish us, once we take the trouble to question the latter two groups with zeal and impartiality, with many specific remedies against various illnesses. These have astonished the most learned of physicians, and if they were collected with care and communicated by the inhabitants of each to the inhabitants of each continent, they could supplement the pharmaceutical works of the ancients. So you see, Nasi hoped to mix, or at least take over, indigenous medical traditions, Indian and African, and to find at the same time a privileged role to be learned, to be played by a learned physician like himself in a colonial society. Even more than the Caribs, there were African actors in Nasi's historical essay, Africans enslaved and Africans free. Here the mixture in his mind had no easy resolution, putting to the test both his commitment to the Enlightenment and its values and his commitment to Jewish law. The African appears in a negative light as warring Maroons, attacking the plantations, helping slaves revolt and run away, sometimes killing the master, including Jewish masters, during the raid. Until they make peace, which they do now and again, the Maroons are the villains of the historical essay on the colony of Suriname, along with the white abusers and persecutors of the Jews, whom you already heard about. The Africans appear in a positive light as, quote, good Negroes, the French as les bons nègres, and the best slaves, who, under the leadership of Jewish and Christian captains, fight against the Maroons, burn their villages, and take them prisoner. Nasi also spoke admiringly of the Black Rangers, the manumitted slaves used to finish the war against the Maroons. Nasi made no place in his text to discuss moral issues in regard to slavery, as he did in regard to prejudice against the persecution of Jews. He quoted the Abbe Raynal in regard to Jewish freedom, quote, may the Jewish people once enslaved, then conquering, then degraded for 20 centuries, live one day free, tranquil, and happy in a corner of the universe. But he did not quote Abbe Raynal's many comments in regard to African liberty. The prescription in Deuteronomy 23 that a fugitive slave must not be returned to a master, but given refuge, as thou shalt remember that thou wast once a bondman in the land of Egypt, was not cited. But then the Bible was never cited in Nasi's Enlightenment history. He did speak of, quote, the natural inclination of slaves to seek their liberty. And we do find him manumitting, for instance, his slave Ajuba and her son Peter, among other slaves, during his years as plantation owner. Furthermore, he was critical of, quote, the rage of the whites against the Negroes, the cruel punishments the deserters are made to suffer, which only enhance the desire of slaves to escape. Slaves, he said, must be treated with gentleness, not with tyranny. In short, Nasi's position, taken in the midst of a slave society, resembles the critique made by European visitors to Suriname, such as the English novelist Aphra Behn a century earlier, and Nasi's contemporary, the soldier John Gabriel Stedman, cruel punishment of slaves was wrong, the institution of slavery itself was not challenged. Certainly, Nasi would have received little anti-slavery encouragement from Dutch critical thought. Neither Dutch republicanism of the late 18th century nor Freemasonry in the Netherlands took a strong position against slavery in the colonies. This is not true elsewhere in other parts of Europe, but that's the case in the Netherlands. Nasi's most important connections with abolitionist sentiment were made during his 3 years in Philadelphia, where there were Jewish members of the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery. In August 1792, only a few months after his arrival, Nasi manumitted the two domestic slaves whom he and his daughter had brought from Suriname, keeping them on instead as indentured servants. Nasi's portrait of Jewish plantation owners in the 1788 historical essay were drawn primarily to respond to criticisms made of Jewish owners by Christian settlers, that Jewish masters were either too severe or too soft, and the desertions or estate failures were thus the Jews' own fault, the Jewish masters' own fault. Nasi's most important evaluation of Jewish slave owners he put into the mouth of a Maroon, a story he had from the synagogue archives and from interviewing the Jewish men involved. Peace had been made with the Juka Maroons, and in its wake, 60 Africans quietly fled the plantation of one Solomon de la Pera, a Portuguese Jew. Solomon's son and several other Jews, together with 48, quote, good Negroes from a nearby plantation, went in hot pursuit, but got lost in the forest and finally came upon a Juka village. They were greeted graciously as new allies by the Jukas. Quote, "You're coming to us without fear in the thick of the forest is convincing proof that the peace treaty is based on honesty and not on the usual dissimulation of the whites." Faso, the elder leader of the Jukas, insisted upon a good welcome because, he said, he had belonged to a family of Jews, namely to Nasi's, therefore David Nasi's relatives. He called for silence outside the Jews' dwelling when they were at prayer on Friday night and had everyone bring them chickens for their Sabbath meal. So he knew what they liked for Sabbath. After listening to Sabbath service, Faso addressed his fellow Jukas. "You see, my children, what I've told you 1,000 times about the Jewish people, my former masters. They are not like other whites we've seen. They love God, and they will never do anything before praying to him and serving him with respect." The Jews and the good Negroes then left with a Juka escort to find the fugitive slaves. Now, I tell this tale not because I necessarily believe the Jukas would remember it and recount it this way, but rather as evidence for how significant Faso's praise of the Jews is for Nasi. He puts into the Maroon's mouth, of a Maroon who's made peace, a praise of the Jews as the best of the white masters. Interestingly enough, Nasi constructed a third relation between Jews and Africans that was neither that of master and slave, nor that of collaborators and or enemies in a jungle war about freedom. It is the relation of colleagues slash competitors. We see it especially in regard to healing Nasi's own profession. In the historical essays, he gives numerous examples of what he calls the tricks of Negro healers, sucking on wounds, for example, and claiming to pull out scorpions. In his Philadelphia speech a few years later, he talks of empirical healers and their superstitions. Now, in all of this, Nasi is part of a tradition, a familiar medical tradition, going back at least to the 16th century in Europe, in which academically trained physicians affirmed their professional status against popular quacks, charlatans, empirics, and against popular superstitions. Nasi's refrain is deepened by the intensified Enlightenment struggle of reason against superstition, and by the identity of his targets as Africans and Indians rather than as simple local European healing women or healing peasants. Yet there is a difference in Nasi's complaint. He himself had been trained by apprenticeship, not by a European faculty of medicine. And as we have seen in his self-preservation to the American Philosophical Society, he saw distinct advantages to his connections with Africans and Indians in a settler society. Even in the midst of unmasking the deceptions of the empirics, Nasi insisted that there were some black healers, quote, with a remarkable knowledge of the medical plants of the country, with which they have made astonishing cures, saving whites and Negroes from death. He had done all he could to purchase the secret for a cure for tetanus from a famous healer named Sowade. The ideal role Nasi envisioned for himself was that of collector, co-opter, and communicator of this African medical lore. Instead, he fretted, Africans and Europeans were flocking to the black healers, genuine or fake. Quote, the Negroes with their herbs and their frightful unworthy ceremonies are viewed by prophets as prophets by both Christians and Jews, especially by the white women. It's enough to have a black skin, he complained, to be in a position to do more than all the physicians put together. It can be no accident that Nasi developed this competitive view, this competition with the black healers, in the decade after the fall of so many Jewish planters, their removal to Paramaribo, and their concentration in a middle class of traders, professionals, and civil servants. Contempt for the Jews emerged among the settlers, Nasi says, when they lost their wealth. The insulting word smous, pig in Dutch, was thrown at them, Portuguese and German Jews both, and even the slaves picked it up from their masters and shouted it out. Now in Paramaribo, smaller civil posts were being denied the Jews, says Nasi. Quote, while the mestis and the mulattoes, both bastards and legitimate, have lucrative employment at the expense of these unhappy whites. This is all the more ironic, Nasi goes on, because, quote, the mothers of those mulattoes are often the freed slaves of the Jews. Now, if the mothers of those free mulattoes were once the slaves of the Jews, then the Jews are the fathers of their young competitors. We come finally to the last category framing Africans and Jews in Nasi's historical essay, that of kin. In addition to the oblique reference you just heard, Nasi mentioned this relation only briefly in the book. Once in a figure, he said in the free population of Suriname of about 4,000 people, there are 650 about free Negroes and mulattoes, and 100 of them are Jews. Once he mentions it in a footnote, in a section where he's celebrating in his Enlightenment mode the religious tolerance of Suriname. He describes the perfect union in a family where, quote, an honest Jew, a man of wide reading and good judgment, had a negress in French, for his concubine, who gave him several children who were raised in the Reformed religion. The father married the eldest daughter legitimately to a Roman Catholic widower, a man of much merit, who had from his first marriage a son born in Russia and raised in the Greek church. Thus, the father was Jewish, the mother pagan, the husband Catholic, the wife Calvinist, and the child Greek Orthodox. And he clearly enjoyed that example. Now, with this concubine, as he would call, that's his quote, and these free blacks and mulattoes, we enter a world almost secret to the historical essay, but discussed extensively at the meetings and in the Portuguese minutes of the Council of the Portuguese Nation, of which Nasi was often present as an officer. the world of African Jews and African kin. How did Africans become Jews? By biblical law, were supposed to observe the Sabbath and other holidays, and the males were to be circumcised. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant. And that's Exodus 20. He that is born in thy house, and he that is bought with thy money, must needs be circumcised. Genesis 18. By Talmudic teaching, and I'm here oversimplifying an enormous amount of complex writing and debate over many centuries, but just to be simple, by Talmudic teaching, slaves were to be immersed in the mikvah bath, that is the bath of purification. A circumcised male slave was not obliged to observe the whole of the law, as would be a free male convert, and could not be part of the formal male prayer service or minyan. An immersed female slave was presumably required to fulfill Jewish menstrual law, the laws of purity of the body, but may have been released from the other obligations of the free Jewish woman. In principle, such persons would have to be manumitted in the seventh year of servitude. Now, 18th century practices were not quite like this. A contract was known in the Caribbean and the Americas in which an adult male slave sold to a Jewish owner was not to be circumcised. And this stipulation was probably at work in Suriname. I just don't have contracts. The contracts don't exist. So I haven't been able to check that, but that's probably the case. Unable to count circumcisions, I have used other markers. On the Jewish plantations and in Jewish households, slaves were at least familiar with the Jewish holidays, the laws of kosher foods, and the other halakhic, that is, legal prescriptions. Some observed the Sabbath and other feast days, some did not. It was bruited around Suriname that the slaves on the Jewish plantations were, quote, lazy because there were so many holidays when they did not work. Now, David Nasi answered this in his historical essay in print. He said that the blacks sort of defensively saying, oh no, the blacks use these days to work on their own lands. In fact, he knew perfectly well from a 1773 government inquiry of which he had been a part that the slaves on his father-in-law's plantation had kept the Jewish holidays and complained after they were sold to a Christian master, which they should not have been sold, but never mind. They complained because they had to work on the Jewish Sabbath and Passover. They didn't want to work on Shabbat. They said, we didn't have to work on Shabbat before. People referred to these people on this plantation as smouse niggers, that is, pig niggers, because they belonged to Jews. My guess is that men purchased as adults were not circumcised, and that boys born on the Jewish plantations and in Jewish households sometimes were. Now, since circumcision was performed in some parts of West Africa, this practice may have been acceptable to the parents for their own reasons. The names given to slaves belonging to Jews indicate this spread in practice. Among the Caesars, Februaries, Jupiters, Venturas, and Ajubas, to give a tiny sample of these slave names, are Solomons, Simons, Isaiahs, Rebekahs, Leahs, and many others with biblical names never found on Christian plantations. After the loss of his plantation, we find David Nasi selling his mulatto household slaves, Moses, Ismael, Miriam, and Miriam's daughter, Tema, and Simcha. And by another act, the mulatto Simcha and her children, Isaac and Sarah, with the income partly to go to them toward their manumission, and with the proviso, quote, that they continue in the Jewish religion in which they have been raised. Now, once freed, such men and women would be, quote, washed all over with water, that is, immersed in the mikvah bath, and we can sometimes see this in the what's left of the Jewish records, if they had not already been done so, and once freed, as I say, they became part of the community of the Jews of the Portuguese nation. Along with ambience and education, there was an additional push toward becoming Jewish, that of birth. The Jewish mulattoes and people of color were to begin with the sons and daughters of a Jewish man and an African slave woman or of a mulatto woman. Here the sons were always circumcised, and sons and daughters were immersed in water, given Jewish names, brought up as Jews, and eventually manumitted if they had not been born, if they had been born unfree. And just to give you some of the names of these, Joseph de David Cohen Nasi, of a relation of Nasi, clearly, Abraham de Prato, Rosa Mendes Meitza, Simcha de Jacob Nasi, Abigail, Abraham, and Jacob Abenakur, to mention a few of the Portuguese Jew of African origin. By the later decades of the 18th century, there were marriages between the Portuguese Jewish women and Jewish men who were African or mulatto. By Nasi's count in 1788, at least 10% and undoubtedly more of the Jews of the Portuguese nation were of African origin. This was the most, and here's the important fact here, this was the most mixed formal religious community in Suriname. According to a religious census some years later, virtually no free Africans or mulattoes frequented the Dutch Reformed Church, Lutheran Church, or Catholic churches, though some of them had been baptized. There are Christian baptisms. I've worked through those books. They were not frequenting the churches. They were not members of these congregations, while the Moravian Brethren congregation of 450 was composed entirely of blacks and people of color, most of them slaves. Only whites were the eight missionary preachers. The status of the African Jews was controversial, however. The arguments about it are fascinating to follow and important to follow, since they trace concepts of alliance and mixture where the ligature is not the abstract natural rights of the Enlightenment, nor the water of Christian baptism, but the bond of Jews of color, Kleurlingen, as they call themselves, using an old spelling of the Dutch Kleurlingen, that was their own self-term, had a brotherhood of their own, the Dara Yesarim, the way of righteousness. But the 1754 bylaws of the Portuguese nation instituted a special status for them of congregaten rather than that of full members, yedahim, of the synagogue. Black and mulatto men were part of the prayer service and made up a minyan, that is the required group of 10 to have a service, but could not be called up to read the Torah or invited to carry the Torah around in the synagogue or be the originator of special blessings said after the Torah was read. Moreover, the men of color were to sit in the synagogue on the bench reserved for mourners, people mourning and mourning for a dead person in the first week or so. That is a bench suggesting death, a bench also used in some congregations for men under light excommunication, a liminal provisional place for the Portuguese Jews, but a permanent place for the black and colored Jews. Now, it should be said that these limitations did not originate in Suriname or only in connection with Africans. Already in Amsterdam in the 1630s, the Portuguese Jews were placing similar limitations on the German Jews coming to the Netherlands and seeking to have a place to pray before they had a synagogue of their own. They had to sit in a special place too. The restrictions were then extended in Amsterdam to the few mulatto Jews who came there as well. Scholars of the Amsterdam Jews, such as Joseph Kaplan and others, have suggested that the Sephardic immigrants from Spain and Portugal had internalized the Iberian obsession with purity of blood that had been used against them, and then they started using it against others. That's partly their theory. I think it's more complicated than that, but that's a suggestion. The German Jews of Suriname had also been restricted in their membership rites during the decades before they had worshipped, during the decades when they had worshipped at the Portuguese synagogue at Jew Savannah, before they had a congregation and synagogue of their own. Then the system was elaborated for the African Jews in both congregations. David Nasi was deeply implicated in this halakhic affair, in this affair of Jewish law. For he had been in charge, as you heard, of remaking the ordinances of the Portuguese nation in 1787. And while ridding these rules of their, quote, despotic and superstitious elements, as you heard, he had retained those limiting provisions regarding the limited membership of the African Jews. Then in 1790, on the eve of the uprising of the slaves of Haiti, a year after the outbreak of the French Revolution, and 2 years after the publication of the historical essay, with its Enlightenment pleas, the colored congregation made a plea of their own. First, they protested the state of the Jewish cemetery when they arrived in full funeral procession to bury Joseph de David Cohen Nasi, one of the most distinguished of the Kulerlingen. They were appalled by the water in their part of the cemetery. The regents answered that they could not control the vagaries of nature. And what did the Kulerlingen think they were doing, burying Nasi with the honors due, that is their Nasi, with the honors due to a member of the Mahamad, as if you were a member of the Board of Rectors. Next, the congregation petitioned the Board of Rectors of the Portuguese nation, and then the secular government of Suriname itself, to make them full members, yedahim, of the Jewish congregation, with full religious participation for the men and no enforced seating on the mourner's bench. The petition is very interesting because it's signed by the 24 of the male leaders of the Kulerlingen and 6 women, some of whom signed by X, some of whom write out their full names. It's the only example I know where Jewish women are taking an open and public part in such a congregational debate. Today, it's different. To defend their argument, the Kulerlingen used a biblical version of the universalistic values dear to David Nasi's heart. One ordinance shall be both for you of the congregation and also for the stranger that sojourneth with you, an ordinance forever in your generations. As you are, so shall be the stranger before the Lord. And that's from Leviticus. And the word stranger, ger, in Hebrew, is by long Mishnaic and Talmudic interpretation equal to convert. That is a reference to convert, and it would be known as a reference to the word convert. They repeated this command from Exodus 12 and 22 and Numbers 9 and 15, lest the message not be perfectly clear. The synagogue notables, David Nasi among them, opposed the request on grounds of precedent and political social order. Now, Nasi was in Philadelphia at the height of the quarrel, but he surely had influence on all the formulations of his fellow rectors. The Bible itself and ancient Israel had made distinctions between priests and Levites and others. So why should the Mahamad not make distinctions between the congregation and the Yedihim? Quote, the difference which is found between persons is of such a nature that if it is taken away, all will be overthrown, since in such a case, a manumitted Negro would be equal to a white. Without such distinctions, there would be the shooting sparks of anarchy. Now, the halakhic, the legal argument, seems to me much stronger on the Kulerlingen side. The political social argument is at which the notables was making, which the rectors were making, is at one with Nasi's fear of anarchy in the wake of the French Revolution, expressed in a pamphlet he wrote in 1795, and with his preference for civil equality before the law over, quote, the democratic chimera of perfect equality of all citizens in a state. Utopian liberty, he said, cannot exist without the total dissolution of the social body. So they were clearly reading into this request for liturgical and symbolic equality the broader concerns about social order and the French Revolution. The government of Suriname sided with the Portuguese Jewish notables. The Brotherhood Dar es Yesharim lost its building, and the African Jews remained congregatin. Intermarriage continued nonetheless, even though the male children of such unions were, at least in principle, consigned to the mourner's bench for the first generation. In the early 19th century, colored people, the Kulurlingen, still made up more than 10%, and probably more like 20 to 30% as you move on, of the Portuguese Jewish synagogue. And Simcha de Jacob de Meza, daughter of one of the Kulurlingen protesters of the 1790s, was still living on her timber plantation named Bethel with her sons Isaac, Abraham, and Mordecai. David Cohen Nossi's mental universe had a multiple mix. First, there was the interplay between his modernized Jewish values and Enlightenment beliefs. This seems to have been a comfortable fit for him. Within these associated frames, he could celebrate the new Jewish theater in Paramaribo, where Dutch language comedy was performed free of charge for people of any religion. Within these associated frames, he could argue vigorously against anti-Jewish prejudice. Where the world's threatened conflict, Nossi's strategy was to keep the Jewish world a secret, to be discussed in Portuguese among his fellows. Nossi's relation to the healing cultures of Amerindians and Africans had a different structure. He accorded respect to their healing, which, by the way, most colonial physicians did not. He sought out their secret remedies to weave them into his own medical practice. But the relation was hierarchical. He was to mediate their medicine to other parts of the world. The troubling move for Nossi was toward the African and mulatto Jews. How to reconcile the Lord's message to his people being led from slavery and Exodus with Muhammad's belief that manumitted Negroes must not be awarded the same symbolic dignity as free whites. How to reconcile the Enlightenment passion with which Nossi argued for civil equality for Jews in the new Batavian Republic of 1795 in the Netherlands. He said, birth, religion, wealth, and ranks do not determine inequality. With his defining birth as a factor in ceremonial inequality in his own religion. Well, Nossi might answer, but these exclusions at the religious service are not serious, they are just honorifics. We might add that distinction was long built into Jewish ceremonial life, with women upstairs in their special gallery or outside in the halls, as you see in the Prague synagogue, and with a special bench being used for Jews in trouble going all the way back to the medieval period. Distinction marked relations also with German Jews in the 18th century and 19th century, with whom Portuguese Jews of Suriname virtually never intermarried. I just want to underscore that the Portuguese Jews of Portuguese origin and the African Portuguese Jews intermarried repeatedly. The Portuguese Jews practically never marry the German Jews. The only cases I've been able to find are actually a few Kulurlingen who married the Germans. 18th century style racism reinforced a traditional habit of distinction, but still did not efface the African Jewish presence. A religion of the law does not allow the expunging of Jewishness and its prescribed duties. The law kept the Africans there. In this debate, the Kulurlingen were in fact the champions of the law of the Pentateuch, against the excuses and the prejudices of the Mahamat. And as Moses Mendelssohn proclaimed in his Jerusalem of 1783, divine legislation is the heart of Jewish felicity. Out of this conflictual cultural mixture came a 1797 proposal from David Nossi for a new school for Suriname. He had spent the years, 1792 to 95, as a physician in Philadelphia, attracted by the new republic of the United States, whose constitution and politics he preferred to what he saw as the excesses of Jacobin France. While there, he had heard about, or perhaps even visited, a university not far from Philadelphia. He came back with a plan for Princetown in Suriname to be located at Jew Savannah, safely away from the dangers of life in urban Paramaribo, as American universities were away from Philadelphia and Boston. Located on the plateau that had once been the center of traditional Jewish life, it would be open, as the newspaper advertisement proclaimed, to boys of all ranks and classes without restriction of nation and religion. Perhaps in this unfulfilled dream, for the school finally didn't come about, Black and White would have studied on the same bench.
If you'll be patient for a few moments, I'll take Professor Zeman Davis to room 6 for a few questions, maybe 3 questions, and then we'll be right back. So hang on.